This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Peter Goldberger, attorney for conscientious objector Augustine Aguayo.
Augustine Aguayo is just one of many people now who are refusing to serve in Iraq. Troops in Germany are getting less and less enthusiastic about going to Iraq.
The Canadian Supreme Court has said that people who are in deportation proceedings cannot be held indefinitely. No indefinite detention without charge.
They get a right to go to court. That's not what Guantanamo detainees have, but the Canadians still have a semblance of democracy.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
As resistance to the war in Iraq builds here at home, we're seeing more and more soldiers in Iraq and soldiers who are destined to go to Iraq standing up and saying that they don't support this war and they won't go to this war. The latest case is Augustine Aguayo. He's a combat medic in the U.S. Army who had filed for conscientious objector status in February of 2004 before being deployed to Iraq. My understanding is that once he got there, his conscientious objector status was denied. And the reason being was that the Army told him that he didn't prove his case. So he refused to return to service and went AWOL after his first tour. But even during his first tour, he refused to put bullets in his gun. And I have to say, I was really moved by that. I think others in the Army told him, fine, if you have a suicide wish, go ahead. But he said, I won't kill. I refuse to kill. I don't believe in war.
And when he finally went what they call AWOL, absent without leave, he was actually in Germany at the time. And according to a news article, he slipped through a bathroom window to avoid going back to Iraq after losing his CO case.
His wife says something really interesting about that. And we'll play a clip for you in a little bit, her giving a speech with her account of what happened to her husband, how he was taken, why he was taken, why he resists, and how he escaped, and what's happening to him now.
I think one thing that's particularly important about his case is that you have to see it in the context of many, many more people refusing to fight in Iraq. And in Germany, apparently, according to the Financial Times, that the spirit of the people in the U.S. bases in Germany, which is the largest U.S. military permanent bases overseas, has been falling, particularly about the issue of going to Iraq. The figures are quite astounding. There's a statistic that puts at 14,000 the number of personnel who went AWOL between 2000 and 2005. And as people who've been listening to this show know, this month, the decision by 1,000 active duty soldiers and reserve soldiers and Marines that petitioned Congress for a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. And that was a guest we had on.
Yeah, Jonathan Hutto. He was one of the main organizers. And he hasn't gone AWOL. He's still actively enlisted in the military. However, they're having people who are actively enlisted saying, we don't support this war.
Now, it's interesting to go back to the cases in Germany. The Financial Times interviews a soldier who refused to continue serving. He just wouldn't reenlist. His name is Evers. And he said he had just read a book by Ludwig Beck, who was a Nazi general who resigned after the Nazis, well, it was a Wehrmacht general before the Nazis took power, and he resigned when the Nazis rose to power in Germany. He tells about why he won't go back to Iraq, and he says, quote, "I would die to defend my country or the Constitution in a moment. I would even die to bring democracy to another people," he says, "but I will not fight an illegal war of aggression." So you have a whole bunch of soldiers
that's
now.
That's really so hopeful.
Yeah, really, yeah,
it is
really beginning to move.
Because when this happened during Vietnam, it was the beginning of the end.
That's hopeful from, you know, an international law and humanitarian law perspective. But if you look at what the Supreme Court has said, the Supreme Court has said something clearly the opposite. In 1971, they had a decision that basically ruled that a conscientious objector status can extend beyond religious belief, but they denied conscientious objector status to individuals who say, "I'm opposed to this specific war." And I think there's also a standard out there that says, look, you had to have demonstrated this belief, this conscientious objection, before you enlisted in this war, before for a long period of time. You can't have had a change of heart. So where does that leave individuals who go to Iraq and who see what's really happening on the ground without the filter of this corporate-run media, and they come back and they say this is wrong, and they can't go back? What happens to them? Under our U.S. military law, they don't qualify as conscientious objectors.
I see Michael Smith nodding in agreement with you that you have to have been a CO, a conscientious objector, before you even went into war.
Which basically means that you never would have signed up.
Right, that's correct, of course.
So they're saying anybody who has ever signed up, you're just locked in. You have no right to grow as a human being. You have no right to expand your horizons, to see something and decide that this is going to impact your future actions. You lose that right. While we're remembering people like Lieutenant Aaron Watada and Augustine Aguayo, we also need to think about Kevin Benderman, who was released from Fort Lewis Military Corrections Facility on the 18th of August this summer. He served a year of a 15-month sentence because he refused to fight in Iraq. Jeremy Hinsman, he went to Canada, was denied asylum. We have Pablo Paredes, who was sentenced to 3 months hard labor for refusing to participate in the war. I think if people want to support, where in the National Lawyers Guild can they go?
We'll put up the National Lawyers Guild military task force on our website, and we will also put up Citizen Soldiers link, and they should go to either one of those organizations to get a referral.
We're joined now by attorney Peter Goldberger, who filed the habeas corpus petition for Augustine Aguayo. Peter, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
On Law and Disorder, we've been following the conscientious objectors that have arisen in response to this war. Can you tell us a little bit about Augustine Aguayo?
Well, Augustine Aguayo is a medic in the U.S. Army who is facing a court-martial this week in Germany for refusing to go back to Iraq a second time. Now, he's not a political war resister. He's a conscientious objector. Augustine Aguayo applied for a discharge from the Army because he joined voluntarily thinking that he could participate without violating his deepest religious and moral principles. But like so many young people, his views changed and based on his experiences and what he saw, and he realized that he had made a terrible mistake and he could not continue and could not participate. U.S. law recognizes the military's own regulations, recognizes that this does happen to some people. And when it does, they're entitled to apply for a discharge and receive an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector.
What happened? Did he get to Iraq?
He applied soon before being deployed to Iraq the first time.
He's in Germany, I guess. Is that right, when he applies?
I think that's right, if I remember right. Yes, he was already in Germany. That's where he's been mainly stationed. And his application hadn't been ruled on at that time. Merely filing the application doesn't give you an exemption from when you're already in the military, from following orders and continuing to be deployed. They do accommodate you. They ask to the extent they can, and they're usually pretty good about this. While your application is pending, they try to give you duties which least conflict with what you say your new beliefs are. He went to Iraq intending to be a medic and hoping to have his hearing and be discharged. And he actually had an interview and a hearing and was interviewed by another officer and by a chaplain, and the fellow they assigned to interview him into Crete, he had his hearing into Crete, found him to be sincere and recommended that he ought to be discharged. But that has to go up a long, winding chain of command, and the higher up it got in the process, the more the people that never met him and didn't know him said, oh, well, maybe he's trying to get out of it for this reason or for that reason, and in the end they turned him down for what we say is no good reason at all.
And then what happened next?
Well, so at that point, you do have a right to seek a judicial review on habeas corpus. At least so far, you can use habeas corpus in federal court. If you're stationed overseas, you file that in Washington, D.C. That's what I did.
Explain for our listeners without a legal background what that means.
Sure. It's a petition to the court asking to be released from any form of custody that the government may have you in. And ironically and accurately, being enlisted in the military is viewed as a kind of custody, like being in prison or in a mental hospital or...
Or both.
Or anything else. That's right. Because you can't leave voluntarily. And so... just as a prisoner challenging the legality of a conviction can use habeas corpus, just as detainees in overseas detention facilities ought to be able to use habeas corpus, a member of the military who's asked to be discharged, been denied a discharge, can also ask a civilian court to look at the denial under the guise of habeas corpus. Now, the scope of scrutiny or review that the federal judge can give to the military decision is quite limited. And the federal judge in Washington, D.C., found that there was some basis, not necessarily a good basis, but some basis for turning him down and denied the petition.
Based on some basis.
Yes, and that's the standard. The standard is very poor. The standard of review is very limited in federal courts.
It's like sort of any facially valid reason they give, and you can't go behind it, really, essentially.
Well, any facially valid reason for which there is a fact in the record.
Right.
That's right. Well, that's the point at which it starts getting interesting and exciting, his story.
Let me just ask you, that case went to the Court of Appeals also, right?
Right. But that's getting a little bit ahead, because what happened was when he, just about the time that the federal judge turned him down at the lower level, they subjected him to one of these stop-loss orders. By this time, the case has been dragging along so long, he's almost ready to be discharged. But like so many people who've been assigned to go to Iraq, they extend his date with a stop-loss order.
Wow, how interesting, huh?
And ordered him to go back to Iraq a second time. He'd been done with Iraq and had gone to Germany. I'm a little bit jumping around here, but I should mention that while he was in Iraq, supposedly being given duties that least conflict with his views, he was ordered to take some patrol and guard duty.
Is that typical for an Army medic?
In a war zone, apparently it is. He got an award even while this was going on for his performance as a medic. He wasn't slacking. He went out on guard duty in Iraq, decided what he could do is he could carry his rifle, but he wouldn't load it. He wouldn't put any bullets in so that he wouldn't put himself in a position where he'd have to hurt another person. So actually put himself in greater jeopardy for his beliefs.
That's astonishing.
It was to me.
It certainly is.
So they ordered him to go a second time. He said, I wouldn't go. This time he no longer, he doesn't have protection against going again. The judge has just turned him down, and he disappeared from his barracks for a day when on the day his group was supposed to go back. Came back the next day, turned himself into military police, classic civil disobedience kind of tactic, surrendered himself voluntarily to be arrested, and the MP said, we can't arrest you. We don't have any charges pending against you. Go home. So they sent him back to his barracks, and next thing you know, there's six guys with guns telling him, we're taking you and putting you on an airplane and sending you back to Iraq. He said, I need to get my gear, went back into his bedroom and disappeared out the back window. And that's what he's charged with now in this court-martial, is going AWOL for about a month.
What, did he turn himself back in?
He voluntarily turned himself in.
In California?
At a church in California, and then went to a military base in California. How he got out of Europe and back to the United States and in California is not publicly known at this point. But he turned himself in voluntarily again, hoping that they would recognize him and discharge him, perhaps not as a conscientious objector this time, but at least for some reason. And they do that sometimes to people who've gone AWOL, but not in his case. Instead, they took him into custody, sent him back to Germany, and charged him not only with going AWOL, but with deserting.
Yeah. Which is pretty serious, right?
Very
desertion
serious.
Is a very serious crime. Desertion means either leaving permanently with no intent to return, which the facts wouldn't seem to hold up in his case, or leaving for the purpose of avoiding hazardous duty.
Is there a death penalty
associated?
That's
what he's charged with. Theoretically, it's a death penalty
case. That's what I thought. Yeah, desertion is a death penalty case.
Yes.
Yeah.
In so-called time of war, which they treat this as.
Right.
When was the last time someone was executed for desertion?
I think World War II. Second World War, yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's not so long ago.
Well, yeah, the way this country's going, maybe they'll revive it.
Yeah. Well, in any event, they're not... The military prosecutor is threatening him at most with a 7-year sentence. I don't want to over-dramatize it, but that's bad enough. While he was away and before he had turned himself in, that was the time we needed to appeal. And Michael asked me about the appeal. We did appeal because we thought the judges turning him down really did have no basis. We appealed to the District of Columbia Federal Appeals Court. At our request, they put the case on a fast track. We filed briefs, and I argued it around Thanksgiving time in the Court of Appeals. And we drew, ironically, the same very conservative panel that just decided the Guantanamo habeas corpus.
It was Randolph and Santel you had on
That's
the bench, right?
Right? That's right.
And
That's
they are the ones who, you know, 2-1, Randolph and Santel in the majority, decided that people outside the United States, non-citizens, had no right to habeas.
At all. That's
at all,
right.
Period.
Yeah. So now, they didn't say that in Augie's case, but they did impose an even stricter limited review than the precedents would seem to call for. I mean, our argument was that under the precedents in that court for similar cases, he was entitled to win, and I do believe this very strongly. Guess when those precedents were set?
1965.
From 1965 to 1974. There were dozens of similar cases during the Vietnam War, and the judges then, as the war got less popular, the judges got more generous in interpreting this standard for judicial review. And so the many precedents were set during that time that look to a lawyer today to be pretty favorable.
Real answer is, you know, what we figured out in the Guantanamo cases, Peter, is that Randolph doesn't care about being reversed. You know, he was reversed in the initial Guantanamo cases in the Razul case.
Yeah.
In this recent case, it was clear from Razul that the court's pretty clear they're going to hold there's a constitutional right to habeas, but he just didn't care. Yeah. And that's what I've heard, that he just doesn't care.
Well, tell us the standard that, as you understand it, and then the standard that the court imposed.
Well, the standard on paper is, as Michael summarized it before, if there's any facts in the record, and the record means the record that was made in the Army appeal process, the Army hearing and appeal process. You don't get a new hearing. The court reviews only what the Army's investigation revealed. If there's any factual basis for the reasons that they in the military gave for turning him down, and those reasons are legally valid reasons, then the federal civilian court should uphold the decision. In the precedent said in the late 60s and early 70s, the courts were willing to say that the reasons were not good reasons or that the facts cited didn't really support those reasons more freely than had been the case in when these cases first started bubbling up in the 50s and early 60s, the Korean War and the Between the War cases, or than the courts have in the last couple of years. So I almost feel that Judge Randolph and Judge Santel are daring us to take this to the Supreme Court to see if the Supreme Court will endorse the more generous reading of the habeas corpus power in conscientious objector cases that was said in Vietnam, or the narrow and unsympathetic reading that this and a small number of other similar cases have said in the last couple of years in Iraq war cases.
So is the Supreme Court your next stop? You hope?
Well, we have a right to seek rehearing. There are 10 judges, I think, on the District of Columbia Court, and we can ask all 10 of them to look at the decision of these three, and I think that's most likely the thing we'll do next. Gives us a chance to look at the case from a one more time before taking it to the Supreme Court. And then we have to think about, will we take it to the Supreme Court? Michael's the expert on taking cases like this to the Supreme Court.
Well, we'll see, Peter. We're going up, obviously, under cases.
I know.
But, in this case, who knows? Supreme, it may be the time.
You know, some people have said, tongue-in-cheek, the Supreme Court's the most liberal appeals court in the country these days.
Yeah, but it may not be getting any better.
But, I think it may be. We've been getting, look what's happened in the cases.
The Supreme Court does appear to be more willing to apply law to these cases.
Right. At least five of the judges.
Than prejudice. Yeah.
Five of the judges today, and which is a slim margin, but it's still five.
Yeah. Yeah. Stevens, hang on. Mm-hmm. For those listeners who've just tuned in, we've been talking to attorney Peter Goldberger, who is the pro bono attorney for Augustine Aguayo. Peter, what are your last thoughts, if you want to sum up this whole situation got yourself involved in?
Yeah, the most recent development in Augie's case is one that I want to mention because it's rather exciting. Did you know the Mexican government just announced their formal support for him? The Mexican legislature passed a resolution condemning his court-martial trial. They're sending a diplomatic observer because Augie was born in Mexico, moved to Los Angeles. He's become an American citizen, but Mexico still views him as a native son and I believe as a dual citizen.
So that's fantastic.
That's really amazing.
So as they made a statement, the Mexican Congress made a statement against the war in Iraq and in support of Augustine Aguayo and are sending a consular representative to his court-martial.
Yeah, Amnesty International has sent representatives to his court-martial as well in Germany. Peter Goldberger, thank you so much. We offer you our best support, and hopefully we'll have you on to congratulate you very soon.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, you have our great admiration.
Yes, Peter. It's really a great
work.
Case. Congratulations.
Thanks for having me. You do wonderful work.
Conscientious objector status has been a long tradition in American history, more in the statement than in the actual giving it to people. But the big cases came, as Peter said, in 1965 to 70 during the Vietnam War. And the first mother of all cases, really, is Seeger versus United States. And that's actually Pete Seeger, who refused to go into the draft, rather, on the conscientious objector status. He went up saying, I don't believe in a supreme being, and that was the first case that held that you don't have to believe in a supreme being to be a conscientious objector, and it's actually Pete Seeger who brought that case to the court.
We now go to a speech by Helga Aguayo, Augustine Aguayo's wife. We'll also hear from one of his twin daughters.
Thank you, everyone, for being here and for showing your support to this important cause. And thank you for Augustine's family for coming out. This is the first time they are all here together in support of him, his parents, aunts, uncles, and I can't thank them enough. I am the wife of Augustine Aguayo, conscientious objector and war resister. I don't know how many of you know this story, but on September 1st, he got orders to deploy and refused to deploy and was told by his second lieutenant not to go to the deployment because they didn't want a domino effect. My husband stayed home and waited for them to come for him and then decided to go because we were fearful that they would take him by force, and that is what happened. Came to the apartment looking for him. The next day, my husband turned himself in to the MP station, only to find out that he would not be court-martialed, but that he would be taken by force to Iraq in shackles, handcuffs, and taken, lifted onto the plane if need be. When he saw the opportunity, he escaped, got out the back window of our apartment. And what I want people to know is that that was not an act of cowardice. It was an act of bravery. It would have been much easier for him to go to Iraq. He went to Iraq once before, and for 2004, 2005, as a conscientious objector. And when he went there, he refused to load his gun. My husband is not a coward. While there, he did guard duty, patrols without ammunition, and the unit knew about it and said, if he wishes to die, if he has a death wish, so be it. They still put him on guard duty, and they still sent him out on patrols. My husband, when he went to Iraq the first time, thought that because he had followed all the rules and was doing what was required of him as a conscientious objector, filling out the application, doing all the interviews, that he would be found to be a conscientious objector, but he was not. 6 months into his deployment, he was denied, and his status was taken away. And he continued to work and serve. But after being in Iraq, he knew that he, when he went, that he would not kill. But after being there, he knew he could never go back and support that. And so on September 1st, he refused to go. And I don't know how many of you saw that, but he held a press conference on September 26th in Los Angeles. And then with the support of wonderful, lovely people, peace lovers such as ourselves, he turned himself in Barstow, Fort Irwin. And the unit was so angry with him and so outraged with his actions that they actually had the same two sergeants that lost him come and get him, and they took him back to Mannheim. He's currently in pretrial confinement, and he's facing 7 years. He's a good person. He doesn't deserve this. And I can't thank you enough for supporting us and for allowing me to share our story and for just holding our hands when we need to be, when you do, and giving us a hug because, you know, this is really hard for us. One of my daughters has prepared something to say on behalf of both of my daughters, and she'd like to read it. Her name is Raquel.
We are really proud of our dad. He taught us to stand up for what we believe in, so we support him even though this has been really hard. I wish our dad was home. We think this is unfair, and we want people to know that our father is such a good person and he does not deserve this. We are a strong family and we are going through this together. Our father is not the only one suffering. We all are. But he is standing up for what he believes in, and we believe in him. We don't care that people think he's a coward, because we know he is not. He is our hero, and we will be together soon. For now, we really miss him, and your support has made this hard time easier, and we just wanted to thank you.
That was Helga Aguayo, wife of conscientious objector Augustine Aguayo.
We want to just update listeners on the Augustine Aguayo situation. Although faced with a maximum of 7 years in prison, Augustine was sentenced to 8 months in the brig for following his conscience and refusing to participate in the illegal war in Iraq.
Recently, Canada's highest court rejected a detention measure called the Security Certificate System that would allow Canadian authorities to detain foreign-born terrorism suspects indefinitely without charge while their deportation was being reviewed. Canadian Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin wrote, "The overarching principle of fundamental justice that applies here is this. Before the state can detain people for significant periods of time, it must accord them a fair judicial process. This decision strikes a powerful contrast to the Military Commissions Act passed last year in this country, the appeals court decision that we saw recently that did not allow Guantanamo detainees to access the federal courts here in the United States, and the case of Turkmen that the Center for Constitutional Rights fought and unfortunately lost in the courts recently. In this country, we've basically stripped federal courts of authority to hear challenges through petitions for writs of habeas corpus. It's good to know that our neighbors haven't. Amnesty International Canada has long campaigned against the detention measure, and we're pleased to welcome Alex Neave, Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about this Canadian Security Certificate System?
Well, the Immigration Security Certificate System has been in place in Canada for quite a number of years. It's received a lot of attention in the aftermath of September the 11th, when it's been used in a number of cases, but it actually predates September the 11th. And it's a process under which non-citizens in Canada, against whom there are security allegations of some description, and we often don't know much about the substance of the allegations, have a security certificate imposed against them, which then kicks in a process that's problematic in a number of ways. They are detained and subject to quite lengthy periods of detention in many cases. And then the legal proceedings that are instituted to look at their case and determine whether it's legitimate that they were subjected to this certificate are deeply flawed. They don't come anything close to meeting international standards governing fair trials. The individuals don't really have any kind of meaningful opportunity to mount an effective defense. The bulk of the evidence is withheld from them. They have no chance to question the witnesses who are the sources of the key allegations against them. They're actually kept out of the courtroom for many, many days of the hearings. And all of this is of particularly grave concern because what's awaiting at the end of this process is a decision whether or not the person is going to be deported from Canada. And in almost all of these cases, and certainly the cases post-September the 11th that Amnesty International has been following, we're talking about individuals who are going to be sent back to countries where there's really hardly any question at all that they're going to face serious human rights violations, including torture. So the consequences are grave, and in some instances, the person's very life may be at stake, and it's all premised on a deeply unfair process.
Can you tell us about some of these cases that you've been following?
All of the cases of recent concern have been Arab Muslim men, some of whom have had permanent resident status in Canada, which is not obviously full citizenship, but means that they've come some way through the Canadian immigrant processes and have a right to be able to stay and live in Canada. Others were at earlier stages in their cases, were in the process of having made refugee claims, for instance. They came from a variety of countries, Syria, Egypt, Algeria, and Morocco. And all of them were accused of differing levels of involvement in or support for terrorist activities. Two of the Egyptian men are alleged to have been involved in an extremist fundamentalist Egyptian organization, one of whom was actually tried and sentenced in absentia in Egypt and convicted of membership in that organization, but never had an opportunity to defend himself in those proceedings. But as I say, we really don't know a lot more than that because the evidence is withheld. It's certainly not shared publicly, but it's also not shared with the men themselves and their legal teams.
Tell us about the recent court victory.
Well, organizations like Amnesty International had been working for years in concert with other NGOs, legal academics, the men themselves and their lawyers to try to change this process. And a lot of that involved political lobbying, but there certainly has always been a very concerted legal strategy as well. So there's been the two planks to the strategy here, trying to get the politicians to agree that the process is unfair and should be reformed, while at the same time trying to get the courts to agree that the system is unfair and ordering the politicians to reform the process. With time, I think it became increasingly, sadly, clear that politicians weren't up to the challenge on their own. We've been through two different governments in the last few years here in Canada. Both of them showed absolutely no willingness to take up the challenge of reform and show the kind of leadership that would have been involved in making sure that this was a system that complied with international human rights standards.
Now, just to insert something in here on that issue, you know, we're facing that in the United States in the sense of trying to get our Congress, which is now Democratic, to change some of our laws that are similar, particularly the one around habeas and denial of the right to go to court. And, you know, I don't feel optimistic about it. It's very, I mean, I've always had, you know, we all have these expectations, and then in the end, the courts are the ones that wind up granting us the rights. And it's interesting to hear you had the same experience in Canada.
Oh, I think absolutely overwhelmingly that's becoming the case here. And it's actually the senior levels of court that we're having to look to as well at lower levels of court. And I think there's been some of this experience in the United States as well. Again, judges often don't have the right courage or insight or don't feel that they're ready or prepared to be the ones who take the first courageous step forward.
Alex, it's the same here exactly. You know, we just lost, as you know, the Guantanamo case is 2-1 in the circuit, the second time we've lost in the circuit, and we now got to go to the Supreme Court where we have a narrow majority, but at least a majority.
Well, that's exactly what had happened here with respect to the security certificates. The lower level of court, which is our federal court here in Canada, at both first instance and the Federal Court of Appeal, had consistently upheld the security certificates, had ruled that they do conform with the Canadian Constitution, our Charter of Rights, that they're a fair balance, that they adequately protect the rights of the individual detainees, etc. And I think all of us knew that if anything was going to give, it was going to have to be at the level of the Supreme Court. And so once it, not just one or two, but three of the cases were granted leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, and then were all consolidated into one group, all of the organizations who have been concerned about this knew that was where we really had to focus our attention. So last June, when the court held the hearings, groups like Amnesty International, but a range of civil liberties and Muslim organizations and refugee agencies in Canada all banded together, and many of us were granted intervener status and were present, made submissions to the court highlighting the key human rights principles that we felt were at stake here.
Alex Nave, who's the Secretary General of Amnesty International in Canada. Alex, we interviewed your fellow countrywoman, Maureen Webb, last week, the author of a book on global surveillance, which I just finished. It's a magnificent book. She makes the point that the United States was very influential, perverting, if you will, the law of Canada in these undemocratic ways. And I wondered whether the security certificate system in Canada was in any way influenced by America's misleadership.
Well, I think the system itself, as I said, predates September the 11th. So it goes back quite some time, over 20 years, actually. So it can't be attributed to the current very problematic environment and the kind of influence that does come from south of the border. But what I do think has played out over these last few years is the lack of willingness, the absence of leadership on the part of the Canadian government as it became increasingly clear that Canadians were very concerned about this system, that a whole variety of authoritative bodies, including a number of UN human rights agencies, were criticizing the security certificate process and calling for it to be reformed. The fact that the government consistently failed and refused to live up to that need to push forward with some reforms, that I think is probably in large part attributable to grave concern that they didn't want to do anything that would be interpreted south of the border as Canada going soft on terrorism. And you saw that when the Supreme Court decision did come out a couple of weeks ago and our ministers and other spokespeople were out there responding to it. There certainly often was that question raised, you know, Minister, are you concerned that south of the border this is going to be viewed as Canada going soft on terrorism? That always lingers there as the big question, how will the American government respond to this, and is that going to cause problems in the relationship?
You know, Alex, on that issue, when I've been giving talks lately, I say, well, let's look at Canada, because Canada seems to still have either democracy or a semblance of democracy left, and we cite this recent decision and then recite, of course, what Canada did with Mahar Arar, the Canadian citizen who was deported and tortured in Syria, and the fact that Canada awarded him $9 million. And I'm sure you guys were involved in his case as well. In fact, I know you were. So it just seems to me that Canada is at least pushing forward to some extent.
And I think that is the key message that our government and our commentators and all Canadians need to repeat and be very proud of, is that this is not about Canada being soft on terrorism or Canada not being concerned about security. Of course we're concerned about terrorism. Of course we're concerned that there be meaningful security. Those are human rights imperatives. But what developments like the Meher Arar case, the recent Supreme Court decision, and then the decision on the part of our Parliament not to renew some problematic provisions of our Anti-Terrorism Act, what all of that demonstrates is that Canada's message to the United States, to the world, to Canada, is that our approach to countering terrorism will always be entirely within the framework of international human rights, that that's what human rights and justice demand, but also durably in the long term, that's our best recipe for security.
Alex Neave, on that note, we're going to let you go before your voice goes completely. We thank you for joining us today on Law and Disorder. Alex Neave, Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Alex.
It was great.
All right.
This is Michael Smith. We are here at Cooper Union for the Left Forum of 2007, and we're going to go now to hear Cornel West, Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Princeton, from this weekend's Left Forum opening plenary entitled Forging a Radical Political Future. Let's have a listen.
Let me say that I'm honored to be here, and I want to thank my new friend and dear Sister Lisa for that very kind and generous introduction. I want to salute the director, Sister Julie Rubin, for her work with her committee and so forth. They've done a magnificent job, and it is very, very pleasant to be able to see each and every one of you all on this Friday night. It's been a while since I've been blessed to be here at these Left Forums, which used to be the Socialist Scholars Conference. It goes back to over 25 years. I was then a young man, a young brother, shaped by so many of the very important conversations that take place in the context of these various panels. And I say this especially to young people. This ought to be part and parcel of your Left Paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A, your formation of attention and your cultivation of leftist sensibilities and your maturation of leftist commitment and courage and conviction. It's very important. I say that because I think there is a role for connecting the leftist future with the leftist past. That when I walked in the room and I thought of my dear brothers like Paul Sweezy, who's no longer here, and Harry Magdoff and Beattie Magdoff, no longer here, and Sister Phyllis and Brother Julian Jacobson, she's here, but not here in the room. He's no longer in space and time. And one can go on and on. Ozzie Davis, no longer here. Our dear sister Ellen Willis, no longer here. This is leftist piety, the way Plato defined it in the Euthyphro, where you acknowledge those to whom you are indebted so that you cannot connect the three dimensions of time, the future, and past and present, unless you acknowledge the continuity and the richness of that tradition, even as it undergoes transformation and transfiguration over time. And when I think of those towering figures, I could go on and on, but I won't get too nostalgic. I get too sentimental, and I'm Chekhovian. I don't like sentimentality. But I am touched deeply by those persons who have come before, who mean so very much to me. And I say to myself, what does it really mean to be a leftist in the early part of the 21st century? What are we really talking about? And I can just be very candid with you. It means to have a certain kind of temperament, to make certain kinds of political and ethical choices, and to exercise certain analytical focuses and targeting on the catastrophic and the monstrous, the scandalous, the traumatic that are often hidden and concealed in the deodorized and manicured discourses of the mainstream. That's what it means to be a leftist. So let's just be clear about it. So that if you were concerned about structural violence, if you're concerned about exploitation at the workplace, if you're concerned about institutionalized contempt against gay brothers and lesbian sisters, if you're concerned about organized hatred against peoples of color, if you're concerned about a subordination of women, that's not cheap PC chit-chat. That is a calling that you're willing to fight against and try to understand the sources of that social misery at the structural and institutional level and at the existential and the personal level. That's what it means, in part, to be a leftist. That's why we choose to be certain kinds of human beings. That's why it's a calling, not a career. It's a vocation, not a profession. That's why you see these veterans still here year after year after year, because they are convinced they don't want to live in a world and they don't want to be human in such a way that they don't exercise their intellectual and political and social and cultural resources in some way to leave the world just a little better than it was when they entered. That's in part what it means to be a leftist. Now, what does that mean for me? It means for me in the United States, and I go back now the 400 years of Jamestown. You all know this is the 400th anniversary of the first enduring English settlement in the New World. There was Roanoke before, but it didn't last. Jamestown lasts. And what do you have at Jamestown? The Virginia Club of London, an extension of the British Empire, makes its way over, the three boats whose names we need not go into at the moment. And what do? They interact with another empire, the Towhatan Empire, that's already in place of indigenous peoples. You actually get the clash of empire. This is the age of empires. But what are they here for? Looking for gold and silver and secondarily to civilize the natives. So already you get America as a corporation before it's a country. Corporate greed is already sitting at the center in terms of what is pushing it. And corporate greed, as Marx understood it, capital as a social relation, an asymmetric relation of power with bosses and workers, with those at the top who will be able to live lives of luxury and those whose labor will be both indispensable, necessary, but also exploited in order to produce that wealth. Then there's religion to civilize the indigenous peoples. Now, you can't talk about the U.S. experience, and I think in many ways this is true for the New World experience, without talking about the dominant role of religion as an ideology. And we also know one of the reasons why vast numbers of our fellow citizens today in the United States, one of the reasons why they're not leftists is precisely because they have not been awakened from their sleepwalk and they have not been convinced that they ought to choose to live a life the way we have chosen, in part because we've been cast with the mark of the anti-religious or the naively secular or what have you. And that's 98% of fellow citizens. So no matter what kind of political organization Brother Stanley's talking about, he's going to get Gramscian about it. He's got to dip into the popular culture of the everyday people. And 98% of them talking about God. That's 97.5 fellow Americans believe in God. 75% believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. 62% believe they speak on intimate terms with God at least twice a day. That's who we're dealing with in terms of our fellow citizens. You can't talk about an organization that's sustained over time unless you're talking in Gramscian terms of how do you tease out leftist sentiment, vision, analysis in light of the legacy of these dominant ideologies, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, and so forth and so on. But then what else happens? 1619, you got white slaves and you've got black slaves. You have the first representative assembly that takes place. It's modeled on the corporation, but it is attempt at democratic elections. The first representative assembly, they gathered July 30th, 1619. They canceled August 4th because it got too hot. And 13 days later, here comes the boat with the first African. And at that time, slavery was not racialized. You had white slaves and you had black slaves. But the white slaves, you look on the register of 1621, they had names like James Stewart and Charles McGregor. But you look on the right side and you see Negro, 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 Negro. So even before slavery became a perpetual and inheritable structure of domination that would exploit the labor of Africans and devalue their sense of who they were and view their bodies as an abomination, you already had the black problematic of namelessness. White supremacy was already setting in as another dominant ideology to ensure that these working people do not come together. And corporate greed would run amok in the midst of that kind of deep and profound division, which is not just a political division. It's a creation of different worlds. So that the de facto white supremacist segregation that would be part and parcel of the formation of the American empire would constitute very different worlds and constitute a major challenge to what it means to be a leftist in America from 1776 up until 1963, given the overthrow of American apartheid, which took place in the 60s. And then we now wrestle with the legacy, with the triumph of the black freedom movement and all of the white and white and brown and yellow and Asian comrades who were part and parcel of that black freedom movement that broke the back of American apartheid in the 60s. Now, what am I saying? I'm saying in part that at least for me, to be a leftist these days, in the way in which, and I take very seriously Antonio Gramsci's concern about the historical specificity of the emergence, sustenance, and development, and subsequent decline of the American empire. And when you actually look closely at that empire, it seems to me, you know, what we have to come to terms with is the fundamental role of corporate greed, religious ideologies, white supremacy, the fundamental role of popular culture, youth, and acknowledge that anytime you're talking about white supremacy, you're always already in some way talking about the treatment of black women. And if you're concerned about the treatment of black women, you ought to be concerned about the treatment of women across the board. So the vicious ideologies of patriarchy come in, and the same would be true for the James Baldwin and the Audre Lordes, the gay brothers and the lesbian sisters. Movements tended to actually respond to reformist activity in which the struggle against white supremacy was a major catalyst. And so when I think of all the work that I'm doing right now, especially in black America, but always, of course, tied to an interesting coalition, leftist identity is not going to be the major means by which you get at people to wake up and come to terms with their social misery and be willing to stand up courageously, articulate vision, and most importantly, have a slice of people who are willing to live and die for a cause, you see, because they have other stories and other narratives that they use to do that. So I would even argue in some way that Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer were much more important than the Black Panther Party. They were actually building on what Martin and the others built, as much as I love Huey and Bobby Seale. They took it further, but the door was opened by these reformist activities. And what I would love to see is the radical reformism once more become fashionable among young people and then allow the leftists to come in and do our thing. That's what I'm looking for. I better stop now. Thank you very much.
That was Cornel West, professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University. Stay tuned in the weeks to come as we'll hear more from this year's Left Forum panels.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.